alayhi salam, in trying to explain to us the tenets and those governing principles that need to direct the Islamic community, the Islamic, ummah, towards perfection. And we'll start from the Sermon 192, called the Sermon of Qasi'ah, and go towards other sermons that can benefit us in explaining this particular topic that we have chosen, especially concerning the fact that it is very important at this day and age to have a clear understanding of what Islam has to say regarding how societies progress and how they, you know, become lowly, and how they have a regression, or how they fall and stoop. These are things that we need to keep in mind and contemplate. And in the previous session, Imam Ali alayhi salam, I explained to you that Imam Ali alayhi salam has mentioned some of the reasons why societies became noble. And one of the most important reasons was that they had a united front, and therefore they became the leaders, they became the role models and the kings. Now, today inshallah we'll discuss about some of the reasons why societies became lowly, humiliated and ignoble, inshallah, with the grace of God.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam goes on to say that one of the biggest reasons why societies became degenerated, why they got destroyed, why they lost their nobility and became, why they lost their nobility and became humiliated, was because of the fact that they were disunited. They had division and divisiveness and antagonism and disharmony amongst themselves. These are some of the reasons why communities became destroyed, why they lost that position. So Imam Ali alayhi salam goes on to say, Fanzuru, he says, Fanzuru ila ma saru ilayhi fi akhiri umurihim. Yes, Imam Ali says that I explained to you how communities progressed, how they became the leaders and the kings and the role models. But now I will tell you why these communities and other communities became destroyed, how they stooped low and lost all their nobility. And then he goes on to say, حِينَ وَقَعَتِ الْفُرْقَةِ. Why did this happen? When divisiveness, when disunity struck them, when it became something that was common amongst them. When this happened, we noticed that they became lowly. And this is what the enemies do actually, because they have also studied history. And they know some of the reasons why societies go low, why they become weak, and how they become controllable. How do they do that? They know that if we create disunity and strife and factionalism within that society, then definitely that society will become weak and therefore controllable. وَتَشَتَّتَتِ الْأُلْفَةِ. The other reason that Imam Ali alayhi salam says is that from firstly when there was disunity, and then when the people's hearts that were closely connected to one another now became separated from one another. وَتَشَتَّتَتِ الْأُلْفَةُ. That closeness in the heart, you know, got separated.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam goes on to say that وَاخْتَلَفَتِ الْكَلِمَةُ وَالْأَفْئِدَةِ, and when the statements that were coming from them, when their beliefs and their hearts and their feelings inside their hearts began to have, you know, separateness. So they were different from one another. So for example, this Muslim community or and whichever community started to have different statements, all of them regarding a specific political issue or a specific social issue, they started to have different statements, and their hearts started to become separate from one another, and that differentiation began to form. That's when this community started to stoop. وَتَشَبَّعُوا مُخْتَلِفِينَ, and now when this group started to form branches and branches, different branches, you know, one branch was formed, from that branch another two branches were formed, and from those branches other branches were formed, everyone wanting his own word and statement to be correct and to be followed and adhered in the society. وَتَفَرَّقُوا مُتَحَازِبِينَ, when they became people who are disunited and in different political factions, different groups, different parties, everyone forming their own group differently and separately, not realizing that if they were together, they would probably do the same things. And now that they are separate, they are also doing the same things. But it's only that they feel that ego and that selfishness and that, you know, that state of pride and different factors that led to this kind of disunity. And sometimes, of course, is the influence of the external factors who strike division among societies. Let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that He protects us from disunity and helps us to get a united front for the truth. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asl zinde ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by famous Iranian Shiite orator and lecturer Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
شما تو این استیکرهایی که تو بعضی از موبایل ها، تو همه موبایل ها نیست، تو این شکلک ها استیکرهای خانواده رو ببینید، دنبال بکنید.
I don't know you ever see the stickers in the cell phones related to the family or not. You might find that the so-called new definition of family in the Western world can be seen in such stickers too. They include family consisting of a man and a woman, man and man, woman and woman, and single parent, whether the child is with the man or a woman. As you can see, the family foundation is defined very differently in the Western world today, and it is deviated from its true definition. If such a deviation which happened to the family in the West also happens inside the foundation of the family in Muslim countries, then there will be no man or woman who can serve the religion of Islam. Once we heard that the Zionists have the plan to break up the foundation of family by separating the children from their parents and taking them to the streets to educate them.
تو خونه رقیب تربیتی برای پدر و مادر قرار میدن، یعنی تو خود خونه نفوذ پیدا میکنه.
Now we can see that the corrupted Western powers make a rival for the parents inside the family and the house, and instead of the parents, this is the virtual world which is training the children. Now, this hidden type of education will remove the chastity, honor, and dignity inside the family foundation. The children will no more respect their parents. Sanctities are disrespected, and so on and so forth. Thus, generation after generation, we can see that the family bonds are weakened, and the love between the members of a family is losing its true color day after day. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Fi amanillah.
In the limelight.
The Riyadh-Abu Dhabi coalition of aggressors with unending supply of aircraft and weapons from the US and Britain have bombed Yemeni mosques, libraries, hospitals, schools, orphanages, power grids, waterworks, marketplaces, and residential quarters, while destroying the infrastructure, killing over 250,000 Yemeni men, women, and children, and making millions of people homeless. Yet, they completely failed to win the war. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Kayhan International. This article is published under the heading, Saudi-U.S. Terrorism Takes a Takfiri Turn in Yemen. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. It seems the Saudi regime, along with the U.S., its principal backer in regional terrorism, has reached the end of the road in Yemen after 6 futile years of trying to break the indomitable spirit of resistance of the Ansarullah-led government in Sana'a. The Riyadh Abu Dhabi coalition of aggressors, with unending supply of aircraft and weapons from the U.S. and Britain, have bombed mosques, libraries, hospitals, schools, orphanages, power grids, waterworks, marketplaces, and residential quarters, while destroying the infrastructure, killing over 250,000 Yemeni men, women, and children, and making millions of people homeless. Yet, they completely failed to win the war. Now, in a last desperate attempt to avoid defeat that is hunting the dastardly invaders and the equally cowardly Americans, they're using the same stale self-defeatist tactics of decapitating prisoners of war through the use of the macabrely murderous Takfiri terrorists. In Syria, the Saudi-US-Israeli regime mercenaries tortured and decapitated captured civilians in the most brutal manner, and then released the videos in a bid to overawe the resistance, but to no avail. In Iraq, the same bloody scenarios were repeated by the Takfiri terrorists and soldiers who surrendered, as well as against the Sunni Kurds, the Shia Arabs and Turkmen, the Christian minority and Yazidis, before they were routed by the heroic Hashd-Shaabi forces. Earlier in Afghanistan, the beheading of the innocent had started on the orders of the Americans, the Saudis, and the Zionists as part of the devilish design to portray the Takfiri infidels as puritanical Muslims in order to tarnish the image of Islam. Nothing came out of such an inhumane tactic. And, on the contrary, the popular resistance forces, instead of losing courage, formed a formidable front to defeat Takfiri terrorists. The latest crimes against humanity of these ungodly Takfiris occurred the other day in Yemen, where 2 captured Yemeni soldiers were beheaded and videos of the sadistic act circulated. The hapless victims, whose headless bodies were discovered last Saturday, were identified as Sagr, Ghanem, Rashid Hussein al-Maliki, and Muhammad Ahmad Murshid Tawaf. As said before, this seems to be a desperate final attempt by the Saudis, the UAE, and the Americans to try to tilt the balance of war in their favor by providing open support to elements of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and Daesh terrorist groups. These brutal murders, however, far from weakening the spirit of resistance of Yemen army and the Ansarullah fighters, have made them more determined to defeat the invaders. The government in Sana'a has released a statement charging the Saudis and the Americans with responsibility for such cowardly acts of terrorism. Its statement notified the UN of these crimes against humanity, saying Takfiri groups are part of the U.S. regime scenario and policy, and the International Committee of the Red Cross, ICRC, must act immediately after the recent beheading of two Yemeni prisoners in Baida. It said the brutality and viciousness of this crime both pierced the hearts of freedom-loving Yemenis and exposed the connection between Al-Qaeda and Daesh elements and the Saudi-led coalition. The onus is now on the legitimate government of Yemen in Sana'a to mobilize all personnel, including the tribes in Marib and other places, against the Takfiri terrorists in order to weed them out of the Arabian Peninsula, along with the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Americans, and the Zionists.
We find that the effects of such kind of trainings can be found not in every page, but perhaps in every line of his book, Kifayat al-Usul. Plus, Akhund Khorasani authored other books, but I mean his most well-known book is Kifayat al-Usul.
It is said that in his lecture of Principles of Jurisprudence, it was more than 1,200 students. And we can say like, almost 500 of them became mujtahid, and the rest were near ijtihad.
Surely we wronged ourselves, what will we say in front of it?
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is the teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhr Rouhani, a faculty member of University of Qom, and Said Mohsen Naqvi, an expert from the Islamic House of Qom. I would like to say salam to both of these dear guests over here.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
Alaykum assalam and thank you very much.
You're welcome. For today's discussion, we want to talk about an outstanding figure regarding the Shia jurisprudence and religious studies. He is no one but Muhammad Kazem Khorasani, mainly known as Akhund Khorasani, who was a prominent Shia authority and a scholar, Majai Taqlid, and also an outstanding high-caliber scholar of Usul al-Fiqh in the 20th century. And he was, and he is still remembered by his seminal work in the field of Usul, that is, Kifayatul Usul. He was also known as Sahib Kifaya, or the author of Kifayatul Usul. Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, let's start with you, brother Akhund Khorasani, who is recalled and remembered by most of the Maraja of this time for his method of teaching and, we can say, his prominent works regarding Usul al-Fiqh. What information do we have about his early life and his biography?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, Akhund Khorasani, his name was Mullah Muhammad Kazim Khorasani.
That's right.
He was born in Mashhad, the city of Mashhad. And the word Khorasani that we have at the end of his name is basically because of the area where he belongs. For example, we have other scholars, for example, if they were from Shiraz, they were known as Shirazi, or Imam Khomeini, like from Khomeini.
Yes.
So this Khorasani is basically because of his birthplace,
yes,
or where he was raised up. Initially, he had studied in Mashhad, and later he migrated to Najaf, but before that he was sometime in Tehran as well. And he had many teachers of his time. So he's well known in the Hawza because of his book, Kifayatul Usul.
That's right.
Which is a book of principles of jurisprudence, which we generally study after the Usul Muzaffar, Sheikh Muzaffar,
Muhammad Reza Muzaffar.
And the level of the text is a complicated and high level.
Okay.
We generally, people who have finished the Usul al-Muzaffar and the Lum'a,
yes,
in the jurisprudence, then they move on to this. And before even Kifaya, we have a book, Rasail, as well. So it's a high level. And generally, you know, in the Kharij, Dars al-Kharij, or, you know, the lesson, lectures that we have,
yes,
some of the ulama, they choose, when they teach in Kharij, we can say, like, principles of jurisprudence, they mainly talk about the Kifayatul Usul.
Yes.
So it is not an ordinary book, yes, in the Islamic, okay, seminary.
Thank you very much, Sayyid Mohsen. I will get back to you about some of the teachers. Dr. Mamarza Fakhrouhani, what's your take on that, brother? What information do you have about the early life of the late Ayatollah Akhund Khorasani?
Yes. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bi nasta'in. As our brother Hujjat al-Islam Naghavi indicated, the late Akhund Khorasani was born in Mashhad.
That's right.
And after receiving some elementary education over there, he wanted to go to Najaf. So on his way to Najaf, he came to Sabzawar. And he stayed in Sabzawar for some months, around 3 or 4 months. During this time, he attended the classes and teachings of the great Shi'i scholar in logic, that is, who was Mullah Hadi Sabzawari. And before him, he received advanced education in both logic and philosophy.
That's right.
After that, he came to Tehran, and in Tehran, he attended the lessons and lectures of several great scholars. On top of them, the late Mirza Abul Hasan Jalvi, who was a great philosopher and logician in Tehran.
Very good.
After that, he went to Najaf, okay? And in Najaf, he completed his education. In this way, we can say that the late Akhund Khorasani, when he arrived in Najaf, he was already a mujtahid. And because, I mean, attending the lessons and lectures of such great luminaries in Shi'i circles, I mean, in Mashhad, Sabzawar, Tehran, and probably elsewhere on his itinerary to Najaf, made him a great scholar. Yet when he reached the Najaf, he attended the lessons and lectures of such great, big names, like the late Sheikh Murtaza Ansari, Mirza Shirazi, Sayyid Ali Shushtari, and Sheikh Radi Najafi.
That's right.
And
these were the teachers of
teachers of the late, okay, Akhund Khorasani. And we find that anybody who has been trained by such great men and big names, naturally, when he writes, he doesn't write, like a beginner or a novice in that field, okay? I mean, such kind of education makes such a person a complicated figure.
That's right.
Okay, a sophisticated figure, yes, in a better sense.
Okay.
And because of this, we find that the effects of such kind of trainings can be found not in every page, but perhaps in every line of his book, Kifayat al-Usul, plus Akhund Khorasani authored other books. But, his most well-known book is Kifayat al-Usul, which has become a textbook in Shi'i seminaries.
Okay, thank you very much.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
Sayyid Mohsen Naghavi, I have a picture over here of Akhund Khorasani teaching in a seminary in Najaf, and you cannot believe that how many students and sheikhs are over here, including both sheikhs and the sayyids are over here. He is on a pulpit. When I followed some of the names over here, which was among the students, I found big names over there. So talk a little bit about the students and, was his method of teaching followed by his students too or not?
It is said that in his lecture of Principles of Jurisprudence, it was more than 1,200 students.
Yes.
At a time.
Yes.
We can say like almost 500 of them became mujtahid.
Wow.
And the rest were near ijtihad.
Really?
So from 1,200 students, which he had, 500 became mujtahid, and around the rest of them were near ijtihad, who were at the high rank. The names that we can count, for example, we have Mirza Naini, Muhammad Hussain Naini, Sayyid Abul Hasan Isfahani, Mirza Jawad Maliki Tabrizi. We have Sheikh Hassan Ali Nukhutki in Mashhad,
right.
Sayyid Muhsin Al-Hakim, Sayyid Ahmed Khansari, and there are many other names.
Sayyid Ali Ghazi Tawatabari.
Sheikh Abdul Karim Hayri Yazdi.
That's right.
Yes. Aga Bozul Tehrani. He's also a well-known person. And there are many other students.
Sayyid Jamaluddin Gurpaygani, Aga Najafi Quchani.
Yes.
Wow, man, these were themselves great scholars.
These are the great scholars. Wow. These are the cream, we can say.
Yes.
Of the Hawza.
Yes.
So all these cream of the Hawza.
Sayyid Mohsen Amin Ameli, Sayyid Hassan Mudarris, and Sayyid Abdul Hadi Shirazi, Sheikh Abbas Qumi.
Kashif al Ghita.
Wow.
Sheikh Abbas Qumi. All these were the students, Muhammad Ali Shah Abadi.
Yes.
All these are the were the students of Akhund Khorasani.
Yes.
And that's why his basically his method of teaching and the way he used to teach, and the way he used to, basically in the principles of jurisprudence, the arguments that are brought, and the principles that are given, and the way it has been argued in those lessons. This is very important. Why? Because, especially why he became so famous, is because after the occultation of Imam al-Asr, Imam of the time, Imam Mahdi alayhi salatu wasalam, the Shias entered the subject of principles of jurisprudence.
That's all right.
It wasn't at the time of the Imams.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is basically when we talk about the principles of jurisprudence, where do we use them? This is very important to know.
I mean, usul al-fiqh, what is the application?
What is the application? The application is when we do not have any verse of the Quran or the hadith or narration in regards to a specific rule or a specific problem, there we need to follow some principles.
Okay.
In order to get the duty, what's our duty against this problem? Are we allowed to perform such thing or we are forbidden? There we have these rules, principles of jurisprudence, which helps jurisprudence to say whether it's haram, it's halal, it's mubah, it's makruh, it's mustahab. So it's based on the principles of jurisprudence. Until the time when the imams were present in the people, people used to ask them, "Oh imam, what is the solution or what is the duty of mine against this action?" That's they used to say, "You can do it, or you should not perform it, or it is makruh, or it is mubah," for example.
Yes.
So imam used to give the ruling at that time. Therefore, we never needed the principles of jurisprudence. Whereas in our brother school of thought, like Ahl Sunnah, because they followed the Khilafah or the Caliphate, so they entered the principles of jurisprudence right after the Prophet.
That's all right.
So they were advanced. But by the book that we have, Kifayatul Usul or Usul al-Muzaffar, these books are higher in rank as what we see in the principles of jurisprudence that is in the Ahl Sunnah.
That's all right.
Why? Because these are based on the teachings of Ahlul Bayt, and they are more strong, they're stronger, they're higher in rank, they're like, we can say, more weighted as compared to them.
That's all right.
So one of the reasons that Akhund Khorasani became so popular, or his book, is because the book that he has written and the way he trained those students. And when he has trained, those students have become like 500 of them become mujtahid.
Yes.
It's a big thing. It's a big thing. I know some of the maraji or mujtahid who went to Najaf from different countries, For example, I don't know if I can just take the name.
Okay.
For example, Ayatollah Bashir Najafi.
Yes.
He went from Pakistan to Najaf. And he went there with the intention to study, become a mujtahid, and to train 100 mujtahid.
Yes.
And once he has trained 100 mujtahid, he has this intention that after that he will go back to his country.
Very good.
He couldn't go back to his country.
Yes.
Because he hadn't trained 100 of them. Oh. Whereas Akhund Khurasani, we can see in the limited time that he had,
yes,
when he went to Najaf, he trained. So there is a need of being a high caliber,
yes,
in the education, yes, in the training. And if you have gone through the right path and if you have reached to the perfection or the goal that we have with efficiency,
yes,
then obviously you can,
okay,
train others as well.
And Akhund Khurasani used to teach fiqh in Farsi language, but usul in Arabic language.
Arabic.
Okay, so he had mastery over both languages on that time. And that side, you know, producing so many students, great mujtahids, and become the za'im of the Islamic houses of Mashhad, Najaf, Qom, you know, Sheikh Abdul Karim Hayri Yazdi, Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani. Okay, these two big names are enough. Okay, one of them become the founder of Islamic house of Qom, or reviving it in the true sense of the word. I think the method of the teaching of Akhund Khurasani was transferred to Qom Seminary by Sheikh Abdul Karim Hayri. That's all right. Thank you very much, Syed Mohsen and Dr. Fakhr Rouhani, for your presence in this episode of the program. We have one more session on Akhund Khurasani and his book, his magnum opus, Kifayatul Usul, in our coming session of the program. But thank you very much for this episode. It was very kind of you.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
On July 19, 2019, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps detained the UK-flagged oil tanker Stena Impero in the Strait of Hormuz, a channel that links the Persian Gulf with the Oman Sea and the Indian Ocean. In a statement, the IRGC said the Swedish-owned vessel had been impounded with its 23 crew members aboard at the request of the Ports and Maritime Organization of Hormuzgan Province for failing to respect international maritime rules. The British tanker had violated the maritime regulations by switching off its tracking systems. It also disregarded the established procedures by making an entry from the exit point of the Strait of Hormuz in the south instead of Northern Pass. The oil tanker was then escorted to Iran's Bandar Abbas port for further legal procedures and investigations. The head of Hormuzgan Ports and Maritime Organization said Stena Impero ignored distress calls as it collided with a fishing boat on its route.
The vessel, to avoid inspections that we must have conducted in this collision incident, changed its route. This jeopardized the safety of shipping lanes in the region and gravely violated international regulation on passage in marine areas. Accordingly, the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps' naval forces guided the vessel to harbor at the port city of Bandar Abbas for inspection as well as technical investigation of the circumstances, effects, and causes of the incident in accordance with international regulations.
Tensions escalated between Iran and the UK following the seizure of Stena Impero. Britain described the seizure as a dangerous act and called for the release of the vessel.
We need to see the illegal seizing of a British flagged vessel reversed. We need that ship released. And we continue to be very concerned about the safety and welfare of the 23 crew members.
However, Iran said the seizure of the British vessel was legal. It said collisions happen in the Strait of Hormuz, but regulations require those involved to respond to regional authorities' inquiries. After 2 months in detention, Iran's inquiry into the tanker's conduct was completed and a resolution to the matter was reached. Stena Impero set sail in September and left Iranian waters for Dubai, putting an end to 2 months of row. In early June, British Marines assisted Gibraltar to seize an Iranian supertanker off the southern coast of Spain. Gibraltar's officials claimed the ship was transporting crude oil to Syria in violation of EU sanctions imposed on Damascus. Moreover, Britain defended the seizure of Iran's supertanker as a legal move. Meanwhile, Washington praised the move and hailed it as a sign of Europe acting along the line of US unilateral sanctions against Tehran. However, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif slammed the detainment of Iran's tanker and described it as piracy, adding that the objective behind Iran's actions was to uphold international maritime rule. Also, Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said Iran would respond to Britain's piracy over the seizure of an Iranian oil tanker in Gibraltar.
So it's an unbelievable arrogance on the part of the Western powers, but then they've been demonstrating that for most of the 20th century and all of this century.
U.S. sanctions on Iran's oil, U.K. seizure of Iranian supertanker, and sabotage operations on oil ships are all instances of the West's actions that have caused turmoil in the international energy market. Add to this list the economic warfare waged by Israel against Iran. A Wall Street Journal report in March revealed that Israel had systematically struck at least 12 Iranian ships. However, Iran has time and again shown its adversaries that their illegal acts in the Persian Gulf will not be left unanswered.
The discovery of an unmarked graveyard at a former residential school run by the Catholic Church in the Canadian province of British Columbia in May, which contained at least 215 human remains, mostly young children, prompted an outpouring of grief and anger and a wider investigation into similar boarding schools that were open from the late 19th century to the mid-1990s. The probes have so far found some 1,100 bodies at the sites of former residential schools in the provinces of British Columbia and Saskatchewan. A Canadian researcher whose works contributed to the uncovering of the first mass grave has said the discoveries so far have barely scratched the surface. The residential school system in Canada was established in 1883 under the country's first Prime Minister, Sir John A. Macdonald. The aim was to assimilate Indigenous peoples in Canada and destroy their languages and culture. By the 1920s, attending residential schools had been made mandatory for children aged between 7 and 15.
These have been going on for years. The residential school survivors just basically were ignored. Now today, it seems a shock to some people, but it shouldn't be a shock because this was known that it was the policy in Canada. It was also the policy in the United States. They just pulled these kids out of their homes, and they wanted to indoctrinate them. And that's exactly what they tried to do.
Some 150,000 children were separated from their parents, often under threats of persecution. The first mass grave in British Columbia was found after Indigenous elders recollected the memories of young children digging holes in the ground. The survivors have told harrowing stories of how the mistreatment and abuse the children were subjected to at the former residential schools led some to attempt suicide or try to escape.
Many of our children who ran away during the winter and froze to death on their way home. And the quiets, the black robes, start lying about the children. Oh yeah, they're doing fine here. In the meantime, they were missing. And no one had searched for them.
A former student of the Cooper Island Industrial School has described the place as Canada's Alcatraz. In a 2015 report, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada called the practices employed in the former schools, quote, cultural genocide.
We're trying to say, people trying to say now, cultural genocide, as if it doesn't fit in the description of the word genocide as defined by the United Nations. And it's very clear that that's what they did.
These are the hard truths that are part of Canada's history. These are the hard truths we must confront as a society.
The Canadian government has vowed to fulfill the Indigenous people's demands to fund investigations into the graves around the country, but it's come under criticism for failing to do so earlier, as the discoveries made so far have been funded by the Indigenous groups themselves. The First Nations leaders say over 6,000 children died at the schools from causes like disease, accident, and suicide, but there's no clear picture of how many children lost their lives throughout the years. That means there will be more headlines about mass graves discoveries around Canada in the months to come.
The United Arab Emirates is among a group of Arab states that have normalized ties with the Israeli regime as part of a controversial initiative brokered by the United States and condemned by Palestinians. The Emiratis, who have been particularly open about their ongoing normalization process, opened an embassy in Israel this week.
The UAE has never been known for having an independent foreign policy. It has never stood for the rights of Palestinian people. Historically and recently, as you have seen, the UAE has always aligned its foreign policy with the foreign policy objectives of Western countries like the US and UK.
The new embassy is located in the heart of Israel's financial hub, Tel Aviv's Stock Exchange building. This is seen by many as a sign that the two sides are highlighting the role of economic cooperation in their normalization of ties. Last month, Israel opened an embassy in the Emirati capital Abu Dhabi and a consulate in the UAE's business hub Dubai. Over the past year, the two sides have signed many deals, ranging from financial services to tourism. Critics say Emirati leaders have totally abandoned the Palestinian cause for the economic and political dividends of ties with the Israeli regime. The controversial normalization process is very much ongoing, despite Palestinian anger. Palestinians are outraged by the normalization, which they believe is threatening their planned statehood. The stances adopted by these Arab governments seem to be helping the Israeli regime to move out of deep isolation in the West Asia region. Palestinians say those Arab states are stabbing them in the back. Palestinian movement Hamas says this week's embassy opening, quote, marks an insistence on the great sin against the people of Palestine and all the nations of the region. It warned that the move would encourage the regime to press ahead with its crimes in the occupied territories and in the besieged Gaza Strip. Observers warn that the embassy opening, just weeks after Israel's deadly onslaught against the Gaza Strip and the escalation of the regime's violations in the occupied West Bank, indicates that some Arab states are no longer bound by the Palestinian cause. Palestinians have been fighting an uphill battle against the Israeli occupation for decades. Things are perhaps tougher today, as several Arab states are undermining the Palestinian cause by moving closer to Israel. The Palestinian issue was once a unifying cause among Arab countries. But Israel, backed by the United States, has apparently managed to divide them more than ever. Israel has been especially thankful to the United States for pushing the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan to normalize their ties with the regime. America has always been a staunch ally of Israel. But former U.S. President Donald Trump was perhaps the best friend of the Israelis in a very long time. His extremely pro-Israel decisions and policies are still impacting the lives of people in the West Asia region, especially those in Palestine. The The Palestinians say they have come to the conclusion that America's heavily biased stance leaves no room for any further U.S. mediation role regarding Palestine in the future.
As protests continue in Cuba, Iran has warned against any foreign interference in its internal affairs. Tehran has urged an end to Washington's unilateral sanctions on the Caribbean nation. The Iranian Foreign Ministry also highlighted the economic hardships caused by decades of U.S. measures against Cuba, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. Iran says the U.S. is the root cause of many of the problems in Cuba. In a blatant violation of international law, Washington continues to express support for protests in Cuba and seeks to meddle in its affairs. Meanwhile, the Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez has held the U.S. responsible for stirring up violence in Cuba, saying that Washington is using high-tech digital systems to incite protests in the Caribbean island nation. Rodriguez has said that Washington sought to generate disorder and instability to fracture the constitutional order and social consensus in Cuba. He condemned the campaign promoted from U.S. soil through social media to promote riots and destabilizing acts, warning that such irresponsible conduct could have negative implications for the region and even harm the national interests of the U.S.
The United States has, since the 60s, been interfering in the internal affairs of Cuba. Beginning with the Bay of Pigs, they launched not only an invasion of Cuba, but also tried to create paramilitaries there. And in doing so, they also set up a blockade, which affected the internal and the domestic economy of Cuba and had a long-lasting impact for over six decades, costing hundreds of billions of dollars.
A large-scale anti-Cuba communication operation had been underway since June 23, when Havana presented the report, Necessity of Ending the Economic, Commercial, and Financial Blockade Imposed by the United States of America on Cuba at the UN General Assembly. The operation includes calls for violence, aggression against the authorities, and the assassination of leaders.
A lot of these attempts have ended up failing, but these are all attempts to really strangle the nation and strangle really the civilians. And it's very hypocritical of the United States, who's now decrying interference from foreign countries like Russia or China, to have this history with interfering with other nations like Cuba, but also outside of Cuba throughout Latin America.
Protest rallies erupted against the Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel's government over the weekend. Thousands took to the streets in major cities, demanding his resignation amid a worsening economic crisis. The unrest comes at a time when Cuba is going through its worst economic crisis in 30 years, with chronic shortages of electricity and food, exacerbated by hefty U.S. sanctions.
There are difficult times due to circumstances, including the blockade, including the pandemic, which is already causing difficulty on the island for many of the people. And the U.S. is continuing to add to that difficulty by continuing these illegal sanctions. And again, it's not just the case for Cuba. We can go to Venezuela.
The Cuban government blames the economic woes mainly on U.S. sanctions and the coronavirus pandemic. The U.S. has maintained a harsh economic, financial, and commercial embargo against Cuba for more than 60 years. Numerous resolutions by the U.N. General Assembly have indicated that the blockade is against international law. The social media campaign directed against Cuba is reminiscent of many other regime change programs directed by the U.S.
It was just recently that the U.N. voted against the U.N. U.S. embargo, with only two countries voting against that resolution. That was the U.S. and Israel, while over 180 countries voted to end the illegal embargo or blockade against Cuba. Yet, despite these votes, which have been occurring, you know, every few years or so, the U.S. continues with this blockade,
including the 2019 coup d'etat against the Bolivian President Evo Morales and an attempted coup against President Maduro in Venezuela. The U.S. has recently further tightened the illegal embargo under the pretext of fighting the spread of the coronavirus. Many Cubans have grown frustrated with the economic crisis and a surge in coronavirus cases. Although the current U.S. President Joe Biden had pledged during his presidential campaign to reverse some of Trump's brutal sanctions measured against Cuba, he has yet to remove any of the sanctions imposed by the former Republican president.
in the limelight.
The EU continues to look the other way, and those who look the other way are as responsible for the egregious crimes of occupation against Palestinians as those who carry them out, says David Hurst Ryder in an article titled EU's Shameless Complicity in Israeli Regime's Crimes. Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. The Zionist regime works actively day and night to crush all forms of resistance and bury the dream of a Palestinian state. 2 months after Palestinians rose to defend Al-Aqsa Mosque and contest the evictions in occupied East Al-Quds, the conflict barely registers on the world stage. Media coverage is sporadic and selective. It's all quiet on the Western Front. The Zionist regime's new foreign minister, Yair Lapid, has once more become the acceptable face of Israeli rejectionism. Delivering the same message as his predecessors, Lapid was given a quiet ride at the Foreign Affairs Council, the EU's chief foreign policy body, in Brussels recently. He felt comfortable telling the EU that there was no possibility of a Palestinian state. So at ease was that? He wagged his finger at his European audience. There is one thing we need to remember. If there will be a Palestinian state, it needs to be a peace-seeking democracy. You cannot ask us to build with our own hands another threat to our lives, said Lapid. No one in the council challenged him. No one reminded Lapid of what the Israeli regime is doing actively day and night to tear down Palestinian homes with their own hands and bury a Palestinian state. The following is a brief and almost certainly incomplete list of what happens in Palestine when nothing happens. On June 11th, two Palestinian boys were shot in weekly protest in Beita near Nablus at the appearance of an illegal settlement on the hilltop above the village of Avatar. Under an agreement, the settlers accepted to leave, but their huts and the army base remain. Mohammed Said Hamayel, aged 15, was shot. When the villagers tried to evacuate the wounded boy, they were shot. By the time they reached his body, he was dead, according to eyewitnesses. A second boy from the same clan, Mohammed Naif Hamayel, was shot and wounded. These were not clean wounds. The internal damage the boy received was immense. His spleen was seriously damaged because of the bullets the Israelis use, which fragment and turn inside the body. A total of 4 Palestinians from Beita were killed in demonstrations. On June 29th, a butchery in Al Bustan Silwan was demolished.